The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation. On MariaSanchezShow.com.
Hi, this is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you so much for joining us. We have visiting with us author and historian Stephen Travers, who has written a book called The Duke, The Longhorns, and Chairman Mao, John Wayne's Political Odyssey. Stephen, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for joining us. I'm curious to learn about this journey of yours with this book and the American icon, John Wayne. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So let's talk. I didn't realize, I did in researching for our conversation today, I didn't realize that John Wayne had such a connection with USC, as you do, as my eldest son graduated from there as well. So I always say I'm a Trojan by tuition. As we're doing the to-do, I feel like a little bit like an imposter when I go to the games, but it's so infectious. How can you not? So share with us the journey and what was it that was the genesis that had you create this book?
Well, I wrote another book called One Night, Two Teams, Alabama versus USC and the Game That Changed the Nation, which was published in 2007. It was about USC's journey to Birmingham, Alabama, and its effect in ending segregation in Southern collegiate sports. It was the documentary. It was the subject of a Showtime documentary in November and is currently being developed into a major motion picture. So in researching that, all these USC old-timers kept telling me about a wild weekend that John Wayne had at Austin, Texas in 1966. And it was just described as a very, very colorful, crazy weekend in which John Wayne got into a fight or almost got into a fight. The whole thing was mythological. And it really started with that. Now, that alone didn't really sound like a book. But the further I got into it, as I'll explain as we go further, it just became apparent that there was much more to it than the fact that John Wayne was spouting political bromides and drunkenness during the 1966 weekend.
And USC, because I understand he played on the team.
Yeah, he was a pulling guard at USC in 1925, 1926, under Coach Howard Jones, when Jones first started the dynasty. His career as a Hollywood actor is completely entwined with USC. USC was the dominant team in Los Angeles and the darlings of Hollywood. And it was arranged that USC athletes would get summer jobs and extra jobs working as extras on the studio lots in Hollywood. A great recruiting tool for Coach Jones, a chance for the players to make money, be around the excitement of Hollywood and be around pretty actresses and all these sorts of things, which were tremendous inducements. And as it turns out, Wayne was one of those guys, and he goes down to Newport Beach to go body surfing, and he gets into some of those big waves that they get down there at the Wedge, and he dislocates his shoulder, and he comes back, and now he can't play.
Yikes.
In those days, you can get your scholarship rescinded,
right?
In 2 seconds, and that's more or less what happened. He loses his starting job and his scholarship. He doesn't come from money, doesn't have money. He falls into debt with his fraternity brothers, and he says, I gotta pay off my debts. I'm leaving school. I'm going to go to Fox Studios and work as an extra. And so it starts like that.
Really?
Yeah, that's how it starts. He doesn't really start as an actor. He starts as an extra, as an assistant, really as a production assistant for John Ford is really how John Wayne gets his start in the movies.
And he was fairly tall, correct?
Oh yeah, he was a big man. He was like Clint Eastwood, you know, a larger than life figure. He, unlike so many of these Hollywood pipsqueaks, are all in truth 5'6".
Exactly.
He was the real deal, 6'3", 6'4". You know, in his prime, if you look at the old pictures of him, which are easy to find on the internet, he was an Adonis. He looked like a Greek god, not the paunchy guy that we know later.
Right. So he towers over everybody. Now, was his personality larger than life in the beginning as well, or did that grow as his fame grew?
You know, his on-screen personality is completely separate from who he was in reality. He was really quite an intellectual, very well-read, kind of quiet. Women loved him, and he was shy around them, and was very, you know, he was very shy with their advances. Let's put it that way. He was not particularly political in the beginning. He was very polite. He was a very, very humble sort of fellow.
And you describe him, though, on this weekend as surrounded by sycophants.
Well, by this point in his career, John Wayne is now a superstar in Hollywood and a political figure, especially as the Vietnam War is heating up. So what's happening in Austin, 1966, it's a Friday night. Wayne is in town because he's making a movie called War Wagon, filming it in nearby Mexico. And he has been invited to Austin by the University of Texas, who I don't think even knew that he was a Trojan. They just knew that he's made the Alamo. He's a bigger figure in Texas than he is in Southern California at this point. And he shows up, and it's a big party. You know, as you can well imagine, with alumni in town for a big football weekend, there's a lot of drinking. And it's a thing called what they call smokers, which is barbecued ribs and chickens and steaks and all this stuff. A lot of drinking. Wayne is drinking. And Wayne begins to pontificate about what we're going to do to the communists in Vietnam. This is 1966. The war is not yet turned. And, you know, Wayne is convinced that we're going to just go through them like crap through a goose. And we're going to use their guts to grease the treads of our tanks and all this type of stuff.
Are you quoting
him?
Well,
that's kind of where I'm going with the book and the reason I ended up writing this book. Because if you recognize that language, it sounds an awful lot like the movie Patton. And mm-hmm. There's a reason why it sounded an awful lot like the movie Patton. I believe that what Wayne said that Friday night and to the team the next day gets picked up on by a USC assistant coach named Marv Goo, who was a very fiery guy. Marv Goo had played at USC, and Marv Goo was one of the gladiators in the movie Spartacus. Every gladiator in the movie Spartacus was a USC or UCLA football player. He was one of them. And he picks up on Kirk Douglas's speech to the gladiators, which is essentially saying, I'd rather die a free man than live as a slave, when he's saying this to the team. Suddenly in 1966, 67, he starts changing his speech from the gladiator speech to this other speech. We're going to go through those SOBs like crap through a goose. And we're going to use their guts to grease our cleats. And what happens is I interview every football player played for John McKay during this period, and they're all telling me that they go see a movie, Patton, 1970, and they walk out and they say, am I crazy, or is everything that Patton said the same thing that Marv Goo's been saying to us for 4 years? So that's the thread that I go, that I believe that there are the language that John Wayne initiates that weekend ends up being in the movie Patton. And so this is where my book goes.
So are you suggesting that what John Wayne said that weekend, Marv Goo overheard and then used that in the locker room, and then somehow it got into a Hollywood script?
That is highly possible, and that's what I'm suggesting. And there are several reasons for this. First, John Wayne was going to play the role of Patton. It was set up beginning in 1962 when he made with Daryl Zanuck, who later produced Patton, he and his son, although there were some major differences between them. But he was the star of The Longest Day, 1962. That movie was the one that gave Zanuck the imprimatur to go forward with the Patton project, which had been put on hold because the Patton family didn't want Hollywood to make a movie about George Patton. They were convinced liberal Hollywood would portray him poorly. Wayne, however, is set to play the role of Patton, but it goes on for years. And so by 1966, Wayne drops out of the Patton project. Instead, he wants to now make the Green Berets. But what has happened is, you know, Wayne's been around USC. It's his alma mater. He's around the USC Film School. He's doing research on George Patton. And a lot of what John Wayne is saying about what the script should sound like and what it, you know, what he would like to have the guy say. Remember now, a lot of this language is not in Patton, Ordeal and Triumph by Ladislaus Farrago. So where does it come from? Well, it starts with John Wayne. And then I believe it gets distilled into Wayne's speech in 1966. Then I believe that Marv Goo, who was there that night and heard it, begins to use it in his speeches. And then here's where the real connection goes. In 1966-67, a young conservative screenwriter named John Milius was a student at the USC Film School. John Milius is the most conservative screenwriter in the history of Hollywood. He later writes Dirty Harry, makes the movie Red Dawn. He is a legend in Hollywood, but considered the most right-wing guy in the history of movies and a huge John Wayne fan. Who's his best friend? Francis Ford Coppola, who at the time is writing the screenplay for Patton. So is it possible that John Milius sneaks into the old gym to hear Marv Goo make these speeches? Milius' friend is Ron Schwery, who is the student manager of the USC football team. He's also a film student, later wins two Academy Awards as a producer after getting into the business because John Wayne got him into the business. Is it possible that Schwery allowed Milius to go into the old gym and hear Goo make these speeches, and that he writes the stuff down and then goes to his friend Coppola and says, you got to use this in the screenplay of Patton? And then we add one other scene. The end of Patton, if you've seen this movie, at the end of the movie, Patton gets into a big argument with a Russian general at the end of World War II and tells him, I don't intend to have a drink with the Russian general or any other Russian son of a bitch. And the translator says, I can't tell him that. Patton says, you tell him that word for word. And the Russian says, well, he too is a son of a bitch. And the translator repeats it to Patton. Sure, he's beginning World War III. At which point Patton smiles and says, all right, I'll drink to that from one son of a bitch to another. This conversation is virtually identical to a conversation that John Wayne has with Nikita Khrushchev in 1958. So all these threads are going together. I believe it all, you know, Wayne is at the USC Film School. Wayne's talking to USC guys. He's researching the role. This conversation between Patton and the Russian general, I don't think that is in Farrago's book. There's not much on George Patton up until this point. You know, he's not the well-known figure in the late 60s that we know now because of all these the movies that were made about him. So I believe that, and one last thing, Francis Ford Coppola, and why he was selected to write the screenplay of Patton, I'll never know. Because Francis Ford Coppola was a very anti-war guy who wrote the screenplay for Patton as an anti-war diatribe meant to cause people to demand that we get out of the Vietnam War. If you read the screenplay, it reads like that. It's meant to make Patton look crazy with language like, God help me, I love war. I love war more than life itself. You know, this is language that's meant to make him look nuts. Two things happen, though. The director is Franklin Schaffner, who served under Patton in North Africa. And the performance is eventually given to George C. Scott after Wayne gets out of the project and Rod Steiger turns it down. George C. Scott gives it so much color and so much charisma that he turns it from an anti-war diatribe and not into glorification of war, but into a very, very powerful character study. And so Coppola, if his intention is to make it an anti-war movie, he's failed. Coppola, and then finally the last little bit of tidbit on this, Coppola at this point decides to get out of the business. He doesn't want to be in Hollywood. He goes to San Francisco and starts a little production company where he just wants to make little movies and documentaries. Turns out that Coppola has made an editing machine, and the editing machine is being used by 20th Century Fox. And there's no one knows how to fix the darn thing. And they call him up and they said, Francis, you got to come to Los Angeles and fix this darn editing machine. flies down to LA and he's down there and he's working on this machine and he looks up and he's seeing the dailies and he's seeing George C. Scott in an army uniform and he goes, what's this? And they go, that's our new big hit. George, this is Patton. You know, it's going to come out in February, whatever. Well, by the way, I'm the screenwriter of that. It's the first he knew about it. That's how little action he had going. And from there, he gets picked up to make The Godfather. And then then he's going to be fired from The Godfather set. And that can't happen because he just wins the Academy Award for his screenplay of Patton, which he had originally written as an anti-war diatribe. So that's the backstory on Patton.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, was he that disconnected because he had washed his hands of Hollywood and moved to Northern California? Or that's how little the writer had to do with the finished product in those days?
Both. He was done with the capitalism of Hollywood, the money that it was required to make a big movie, the so-called compromises that the filmmaker, that the artiste must make in order to deal with the capitalism of the movie business. And he gets drawn back in through his own talents, through the success of the movie. And then, you know, the only reason he gets selected to direct The Godfather is he was the only Italian-American director in Hollywood who had any connection to Hollywood. They wanted, Robert Evans wanted an Italian American. He said, because, quote, I want to smell the spaghetti, unquote. If you've remember the scene where Pacino says to Diane Keaton, you like your lasagna? Every time I see that, I get hungry. That scene where they're all at the wedding, I get hungry. I mean, I can smell the lasagna. And that's what Evans wanted. He wanted an Italian American to capture this. And remember, Jim Coppola is from Long Beach, Long Island. This scene, and the scene is in Long Beach, Long Island. And he just captures this whole ambiance. And this is not, you know, the Duke the book, but this is where Coppola gets his big kudos, and that's where he becomes famous.
Now, he's Skywalker Ranch, right?
No, that's George Lucas. Now, all these guys are connected. They're all completely connected. George Lucas, John Milius, Francis Ford Coppola, Steven Spielberg are all film students hanging out at USC and UCLA in 1966 during the time of this event. And here, the other thing, they come up with this crazy idea that they're going to get a film crew together with a bunch of actors and go to Vietnam and film a movie of actors during combat. You can believe it. And for some strange reason, the Department of Defense turns them down, and this project gets shelved and eventually becomes Apocalypse Now.
Unbelievable. What a fabulous story with the intrigue, and then people almost, the good news is that talent willed out. In other words, that the right people rose to the top, but kind of in a really curious way.
Yeah. And the last thing on Patton is the Patton family has never given Zanuck permission to make a movie about George Patton. They have a lawsuit all ready to go. And the movie gets played and they go see the movie, and very quietly the lawsuit is withdrawn because they love the performance. And, you know, that movie gets shown at West Point. That movie gets shown at Basic Training. You know, that's considered a movie that glorifies not the war, but glorifies the military, and made George Patton probably the man considered the greatest general, combat general in the history of the United States.
Now, where does Chairman Mao fit into all of this?
Well, you know, this is all beautiful stuff, because here I am, a writer. What does a writer do? A writer is looking for nuggets. He's, you know, okay, John Wayne. Well, what are you going to do with John Wayne? I mean, everyone, you know, what is there new about John Wayne? To find out new things that no one else knew about John Wayne, and to be able to put that into my book, this is great stuff. So what Chairman Mao comes in, Joseph Stalin had a hit out on John Wayne to kill him because John Wayne was exposing communism in Hollywood in the 40s and 50s. Stalin tries to kill Wayne twice, fails. Wayne helps, works with the FBI to capture the would-be assassins and turns them into assets of U.S. intelligence. Wayne's cowboy friends break up a third attempt to kill Wayne at Burbank Studios in 1955. Finally, in 58, Wayne asks Nikita Khrushchev, why are you trying to kill me? Khrushchev says that was an order that Joseph Stalin made. He was mad. When he died, I rescinded the order. But Chairman Mao still wants you dead. And if you're ever in Asia, you better watch yourself. Well, sure as heck, in 1966, the year in which this book is basically set, Wayne goes on a USO tour to Pleiku, Vietnam. Well, he goes all over Vietnam. He goes into the hinterlands. Pleiku is not Saigon. This is a base camp, very dangerous, Marine base camp. He goes there and he's shaking hands with Marines when a shot is fired. Several shots are fired, missing him by a few feet, a few yards. Wayne ducks for cover. This is John Wayne in real life, you know, in combat, the real deal. And the Marines go out and they capture this guy. They bring him back, and sure as heck, he's not a North Vietnamese regular or a Viet Cong. He's got Chinese markings and orders. And he admits that he's there to kill the big American movie star John Wayne on orders from Chairman Mao Tse-tung. So there's where Mao Tse-tung comes into this equation.
So four times?
There were four, according to what I've come across. And I have, you know, pretty good anecdotal evidence on this. There's about seven or eight, witnesses, so to speak, who speak about this. Four attempts to kill John Wayne, two by Joseph Stalin, one by homegrown communists in America, in Burbank, and a fourth by Chairman Mao in 1966.
My goodness. And you'd think, man, four times, and we're talking about not trifling people that are behind those attempts. It's not just a person, it's an entire regime.
Well, you know, Chairman Mao, Mao killed 70 million and Stalin killed 35 million. So you've got the two heavyweight champions of murder
right.
have put a hit out on you. But John Wayne never told anybody because his family didn't know. And his best friends didn't know. He didn't want anyone to know. He kept it. He told the FBI, I don't want anyone to know about this. Besides, J. Edgar Hoover did not reveal much of what was going on with espionage because he didn't want the KGB to know how much he knew about their operations in the United States. So he played it very, very carefully throughout this period.
So he wasn't afforded any kind of personal security or bodyguards
or
anything
like
that?
He worked with the FBI in literally... If the story is correct, literally luring Soviet assassins to the Warner Brothers lot where they are given access all the way to Wayne's office, which he shares with a screenwriter named James Grant, and where they enter the office, at which point the G-men, this is like a real life movie. This is a, you know, narrative nonfiction, a Tom Wolfe book, you know, The Right Stuff or something like that. This is would be a fabulous movie. And these FBI men emerge, draw guns on the Soviets and say, hands up, you know. Now, at this point, according to the story, Wayne and screenwriter James Grant have picked out a secluded beach in Southern California where they and the FBI men drive these assassins. They put them on their knees with down on the beach with the water lapping near them. Wayne draws a gun, puts it to their heads, pulls the trigger, but it's blanks. They are quavering in their boots, begging for mercy and saying, you don't have to kill us, we'll work with you and we'll tell you about Stalin's operations. And that's, according to the story, that's what happens. And they go off and Wayne, you know, finishes off by saying, look, you can do with these guys what you want, but I don't want anyone to know. I don't want my fans to know this is happening.
My goodness. That's just, it's utterly amazing to think, you know, this, like you described him earlier, swashbuckling, you know, big, tall drink of water that pontificates on certain things and lives hard, drinks hard, and everything else. And then he's actually involved in the behind the scenes politics of the time.
Yeah, this is greater than any of his movies. And it's just incredible that it's virtually, I mean, it's not completely unknown. It's really found out by a British film historian named Michael Munn. You got to give credit to this guy. And it starts off, Munn is an assistant to Bob Hope in England in 1968. Bob Hope is a good friend of John Wayne. He knows about it. He tells Munn about it. And then Munn next meets the British actor Peter Ustinov. Ustinov tells him that he's heard about it from Chinese dissidents, that he just made some movie down in Hong Kong and he heard about it. From there, Munn does an interview with John Wayne around 1974. Wayne at first denies it, finally realizes Munn knows what's going on in it and gives him all the details. Next, a cowboy stuntman named Yakima Canutt verifies all the same stuff. He helped break it up for Wayne. Then in 1982 or 3, Munn has a conversation with the actor Orson Welles, who I don't even know if he was prompted to talk about it, but he also tells Munn that he knows that there were assassination attempts against Wayne. So, you know, you've got, now you're talking about Bob Hope, Chinese dissidents, Peter Ustinov, John Wayne, Yakima Kamut, Orson Welles. You know, this isn't just Steve Travers making stuff up out of whole cloth. most of these people, if not all these people, are dead. So, I mean, I can only go with what I have. There's probably a lot of classified information in the CIA and the FBI and perhaps even the Venona projects out of the Soviet archives that could verify this better. Or say it's all wet. But, you know, from what I've discovered, from what I found, this looks like a great adventure.
So, Stephen, your book, readily available?
Yes, it should be at all the Barnes & Noble stores and at Amazon.com and easily found.
And how long was your journey from inception, conception to execution, publication?
Well, first of all, you've got the 2007 book, and that's where the research starts. So, you know, this is where I begin talking to Rick Reinhardt over at Taylor Trade, Roman and Littlefield, about, you know, there's this John Wayne story. And then from there, 2011, 2012, he says, let's go ahead, let's do this. And all I really have at this point, I don't have the assassination attempts. The only thing I have when I get started is I've got John Wayne getting drunk in Austin and getting into a fight with a writer. And, you know, the first reaction to that is, well, is there really a book there? And I just thought I could infuse it with enough color and USC stuff to make it a fun story, an anecdotal story about John Wayne. And from there, I didn't know anything about how John Wayne might have been the language that ends up in Patton. And I didn't know anything about John Wayne's assassination attempts. So as I say, this is the best thing that can happen to a writer, is to discover all these nuggets and turn it into, I mean, think about if making a movie about these events. How many actors in Hollywood today would love to play John Wayne in his prime, you know, evading assassination attempts, almost like the Bourne conspiracy from Mao and Stalin? I mean,
and also helping our intelligence and working with, and I mean, you're right. It would be almost too good to be true. Difficult to believe.
It almost would be. And, you know, maybe you'd even have to suspend a little bit of disbelief. But the other thing is, and honestly, there's a left-wing element that just doesn't, they just don't want to admit that there were communists in Hollywood. They have this lie that they live that, you know, it was just a witch hunt by Joseph McCarthy. Well, it wasn't. It was if you've ever read Whitaker Chambers' Witness, or you've ever looked at the Venona Project. You know, the bottom line on all this, whether we're talking Vietnam or John Wayne, is the communists killed 120 million human beings. And now, I don't know if we fought them the right way or the smart way or the best way, but I do know that opposing something that killed 120 million human beings is the moral thing to do, and giving aid and comfort to something that killed 120 million things is 120 million human beings is the immoral thing to do. So, yeah, you can call John Wayne a swashbuckling cowboy and a jingoist if you want, but to me, opposing the most evil political ideology ever devised, you know, I'm going to give him credits for that.
Just a fabulous, amazing story, Stephen. And you're so articulate with how you're sharing it. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to visit with us, and continued success. And we'll do everything we can to keep promoting the Duke, the Longhorns, and Chairman Mao, John Wayne's political odyssey. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think that's a very comprehensive interview. Thank you very much, Maria.
Thank you for your time, and really appreciate it. And I'm looking so forward to reading the book, because my reading is about 98% nonfiction. So between that and your story, I'm just compelled.
Okay, well, great. I hope you'll enjoy it.
Thank you so much. And thank you for listening to The Maria Sanchez Show, hoping you're helping to make our world a better place.
Talking, so call Maria. Her show is killer. You won't believe it, darling. There's long time listeners and first time callers. They love Maria, that's why they keep saying, and we're gonna get loud, but we're gonna get close. She's here and she's gone. She's gonna help.